Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. A boy washes and rewashes his hands. A girl practices for hours on the violin to perfect her technique. The boy would likely be considered to be ill, but the girl would probably be admired for her dedication to her art. This morning, in this hour of the program, we will consider the nature of obsession as both pathology and goal. And our guest for the program is Leonard Davis. He's professor in the departments of English, Disability and Human Development, and Medical Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And he is the author of the book Obsession, A History. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. And it takes a look at how it is over time in different places. People have looked at obsessive behavior and thought about it. And he makes the argument, the interesting argument, that at least in part for this, and maybe you also generalize that to other kinds of mental illness, the way we think about something, that is, as a culture, as a society, the way we think about a particular kind of behaviors, cluster of behaviors, and the people who exhibit them, goes a long way to deciding whether we think that those are functional behaviors or dysfunctional, or whether we think that that person is well or ill. If you're interested in finding the book, I'm sure that you can look for it in the bookstore or the library. It was published in the fall. And questions here, of course, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. And so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point, of course, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving along. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to join in the conversation. Professor Davis, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm well.
Good. Thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate
it.
We use the term obsession in a casual and loose kind of way, and we can use it to describe anything from kind of an intense preoccupation with something to something that would be considered to be dysfunctional or debilitating and would be considered to be a mental illness. So there's a big range of the way that we use this word. When you think of obsession, what do you think it is that we're talking about?
Well, on the simplest level, I think when a person is obsessed, they are unable to stop thinking about something, although they're aware that they're doing it. So the first definition of obsession is that it's a rational disorder. You're aware of it, but you can't stop doing it. And compulsions, which can go along with obsessions, are activities that you do, hand washing, for example, or checking, which you, again, are aware that you're doing, don't particularly like the fact that you're doing it, but can't stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's on the simplest level, that is the sort of clinical definition. But when you ask me what I think about obsession, I think the point of my book is that when we slice human behaviors or activities into very specific categories, we lose the range and continuum of an activity. And I focus on obsession as one that is both something that in our culture is a cultural goal. You can't be too obsessed if you're an Olympic swimmer or a violinist or at your job, or if you're in love with somebody. The best kind of love is obsessed love, right? But on the other hand, we also turn it into a pathology, and that's kind of what I'm interested in, is the way that we elide the continuum.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to maybe overgeneralize it and make such a big point right at the beginning, but it does seem to me that it's the kind of thing that can be maybe extended to other kinds of pathologies and gets at the argument that I think some people make, and I know that it's maybe kind of contentious, is that for anything that's considered to be a mental illness clinically, there are subclinical levels, and that maybe to one extent or another, all of us or many of us exhibit some of these kind of behaviors and tendencies. It's just that what we're talking about perhaps is a matter of degree.
Yeah, and we're actually in a very interesting moment. I'm sure some of your listeners are aware that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the book that therapists and practitioners use to diagnose people is being rewritten once again, and we're into the fifth revision. And there's a lot of debate about what kinds of behaviors should be included, what kinds of behaviors should be considered pathological. And also, at any time you do that, there has to be a committee formed to say, well, if you do it five times, then that's you have the disease. If you do it five times a week, if you do it three times a week, then you don't. I mean, decisions are made by ordinary people who have to come up with compromises. It's like politics. So we tend to think of diagnoses as very fixed in stone, or somehow parallel to sort of being diagnosed with cholera. But actually, in the area of psychiatric and mental disorders, there's a huge cultural component that's involved. And I think that there's a number of people, not just myself, who've written books about shyness, about attention deficit disorder, about addiction, who are questioning about depression, who are questioning the way that ordinary human reactions are being turned into pathologies.
We'll come back to that, I'm sure. Let me just ask it as a more general question. Was there something in particular that drew you to this topic?
Well, actually, I'm an English professor among my many other appointments, and I've always been interested in the history of the novel. And actually, one day when I was running, which itself is, could be seen as an obsessive behavior, I started to think about, well, what was the difference between characters in 18th century novels and 19th century novels? Sort of the difference between Jane Austen, say, and Dostoevsky. And I realized that the difference in the characters were that the later 19th century characters, mid to later 19th century characters, were obsessed. And so that just got me interested in trying to figure out, well, when did people start using the word obsession in this way? That led me to an investigation of the rise of psychiatry and neurology, and I was well on my way to writing a book.
Well, you look at this in a chronological way, and let me take it sort of out of sequence and here start or talk a little bit more about where we are now, because you make the point, and I think it's an interesting one, that in talking about obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a psychiatric diagnosis for people who have this and for whom it is can be a very debilitating sort of condition, you make the point that, say, before the 1970s, OCD was quite rare, and I think the figures that you give here is that it was thought to exist in maybe one out of every 20,000 people had OCD, and that now some people say that maybe as many as one in 10 people have obsessive compulsive disorder. So that certainly invites the question, what has happened that led to this enormous increase in the diagnosis of this condition that relatively speaking, 30 years ago, was thought to be quite rare?
Well, there are a lot of different factors. And one thing I just want to add in the beginning here is that I'm not saying that OCD is a made-up condition, that it doesn't exist. There are certainly lots of people who have OCD who suffer from it and who you know, in some senses might endanger their lives by what they do. So I'm not putting down the category. What I'm more interested in doing is coming up with how did we get to this point and how do we come up with this particular kind of definition. But to go back to your point, there's an huge exponential increase in the diagnosis of OCD. And by the way, OCD is not alone in that. I mean, there are diseases, if we've been alive in the last 25 years, we've seen diseases come along that didn't exist before, like situational affective disorder and ADD and so on. And even depression itself was relatively rare in the 50s and 60s and has become, you know, endemic. So the question is, why this huge increase? And just to give you the point of view of people who don't agree with me first, and I think a lot of people who are in the OCD business would say that what actually happened was that people were afraid. It's a disease you would want to conceal, and that with better publicity and with better drugs to treat the disease, that there more people have been willing to come out. I think that's a partial explanation, but it can't possibly explain the exponential increase of going from an extremely rare disease to one that now the World Health Organization says is the fourth most common mental disorder in the world. So, I mean, my explanation is that, first of all, there's been a great deal of rise in the treatment of OCD linked to the development of Prozac kind of related drugs, SSRIs. And there's been a huge push by drug companies to have people self-identify, have people identify their friends and relatives, and to to create a kind of what I call diagnostic bleed, and other people call diagnosis bracketing, which is basically that you start out with a set of symptoms. I think the most common thing would be to recognize this in depression, that people begin to learn about it. It's originally a very rare thing. Only a few people are bipolar or depressed. But then people start saying, well, I kind of have those symptoms, and they look at checklists, and, which are provided by drug companies. And also practitioners get more comfortable with prescribing, diagnosing the disease, because there is a readily available treatment now, which would be the use of SSRIs and cognitive behavioral therapy. And also there's a kind of, a sort of joyousness about the discovery of the use of the drug, and that it seems to be fantastically successful, and here we can finally treat something. So there's a huge social communicative media component to the sort of spreading of this. And then also OCD particularly becomes a cultural phenomenon. We suddenly start seeing characters in movies and TV shows who have it. And they're kind of lovable. You know, people like Monk and Jack Nicholson is in As Good As It Gets. And they're in, in novels like Motherless Brooklyn. And, you know, suddenly you start seeing OCD as a kind of positive thing. Sort of like, well, it's just part of being American. It's part of being modern. And I think that then there's a kind of wannabe aspect to it. People have a way of talking about symptoms that they may not have had in the past, and they have a way of grouping symptoms together, which may have been listed separately or may not have been thought of as being a whole entity. So it's a very complicated system by which it happens, but I don't think the explanation simply that people are more comfortable coming out about it is fully explains the whole, what I call the biocultural side of the of understanding something as complex as OCD.
The guest that we have here with us in this part of Focus 580 is Leonard Davis. He is professor in the departments of English, Disability and Human Development, and Medical Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is editor of the Disability Studies Reader. He is also the author of My Sense of Silence, Memoirs of a Childhood with Deafness, and Enforcing Normalcy, Disability, Deafness, and the Body, among other books. And his most recent here, one that we're talking about, this book was published, I believe, in November, officially, beginning in November. The title of the book is Obsession, A History, and it is published by the University of Chicago Press. Questions, comments certainly are welcome from listeners. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone who is listening this morning in Terre Haute, Indiana, on our line 4. Hello.
Hi there. This question kind of goes both at your English expertise and your expertise about the obsessions, and that's, is there really a clinical difference in the definition between an obsession and an addiction? Because we can sit around and say, oh, this student has an obsession with video games, or this student has an addiction to video games. And a lot of times we mean the same thing. But is that the case clinically? And I will take my answer off air. Thank you.
Okay, that's a good question. And it's interesting that you said clinically, because so far, if you're following the DSM, which is our only standard at this point, or one of our only standards, an addiction is, by definition, an addiction to a particular substance. It has to be a drug or or alcohol or something like that. The DSM-5, which they're rewriting, is considering allowing addiction to be used for things like shopping and shopping addiction or work addiction. And if that comes about, and again, this is such a good example of how this is a socially driven, culturally driven component. The component of diagnosis is not simply clinical, but is culturally and socially driven. If that comes about, then there will be a blurring of the lines between obsession and addiction. But I think what's also interesting is that there have been people who have attempted to come up with explanations for addiction that don't have to do with an external drug, but that people begin to say, like, well, if you're obsessed, then you're addicted to your own neurotransmitters, and you get a high when you, you know, you do the thing over and over again, and you're so you become addicted to your own serotonin or dopamine or whatever the neurotransmitter is in question. Again, I think that, not again, but I think one of the points that I'm trying to make in the book is that actually a lot of the clinical diagnostic logic is incredibly simplistic. And, you know, we tend to think of science as being incredibly complicated and, you know, the humanities as being sort of touchy-feely. But in fact, if you look carefully at something like this, you'll see that the diagnoses themselves tend to be very reductionist and very simple. I'll give you an example that's not exactly related to the question, but there's a thing called OCD, which we've been talking about, obsessive-compulsive disorder. And in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, there's also something called obsessive-compulsive personality. And they're essentially people who are doing the same thing. But the difference between OCD and obsessive personality disorder, OPD, is that the person who has the obsessive personality disorder likes it. They don't mind it. They enjoy collecting tons of newspapers in their house, or, you know, they love being neat and clean. So the difference, in a way, these are considered two separate clinical entities, but really the only difference is whether you like it or whether you suffer from it. And then when you consider, well, if that's the Occam's razor, if that's the thing that separates them, then what does it mean to suffer from something? And this also partly explains for the rise in OCD, because you may do a certain activity and you may personally enjoy it, but people around you may say, why are you doing this crazy thing? Why are you checking over and over again? Or why are you muttering to yourself certain words or touching certain objects? And you may begin to suffer by saying, yeah, I must be crazy doing this. Why am I doing this? So the suffering has also a very strong cultural component to it.
Here, and I think this is a really interesting and very important point, and again, I want to go back to some but sort of underscore a point that you made earlier, that you in no way are meaning to suggest that obsessive-compulsive, that there is no such thing as obsessive-compulsive disorder, and you're certainly not meaning to suggest that, you know, there aren't people who have behaviors that causes them a lot of difficulty. Having said all that, though, you seem to be saying that maybe, in some part, if people feel that they have issues with obsession or with compulsive behavior and that's causing them pain, that the origin of some of that pain might be that we have stigmatized these behaviors and these compulsions, and that they feel that there's something wrong with them, and that maybe if we were a little slightly more relaxed about it, that and again, here we're talking about a continuum, but if we were slightly more relaxed about it, maybe there were some people who would say, well, okay, I can live with this. It's maybe a minor nuisance. I can live with this, but it's okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are people, for example, who do certain compulsive activities that actually suffer physical pain. I mean, if you wash your hands, you know, a million times a day, you will begin to get sores on your hands. It'll be painful. So, I mean, I'm not discounting the fact that there is real pain, and that there's also pain from just simply weariness of having to do the same thing over and over again. But I think you're right in the sense that, you know, if we look back, for example, at the DSM-3, I think, in the DSM-2, homosexuality was considered a psychiatric disorder. And you can imagine that the pain and suffering that were caused by people who were gay, who felt that they were doing activities that they couldn't stop doing, but that they were, and these were activities that meant that they were in some sense pathological or crazy. Once the DSM changed and got rid of homosexuality as a, and that was in response to a social movement. If you've seen the movie Harvey Milk, the movie Milk, you can get a sense of that. But once the homosexuality was depathologized, the pain of being gay was considerably diminished. In fact, there isn't any pain now. So the question is, there's a gain for pathologizing something. And the gain is that the person doesn't necessarily have to feel that they're morally responsible for doing what they're doing. They can say, I have a disease or an illness. But the loss is that there is a kind of, you know, you said stigma, I think that's a good word. There's this pressure from family members. Rather than, you know, in the 18th century, if somebody was, you know, Dr. Samuel Johnson, who wrote the first dictionary, was known to be this kind of guy who was eccentric. And if you look at his eccentricities, they were very much tied up with Tourette syndrome and OCD. He had to touch every lamppost he walked by. He had to hesitated to enter doors. He had to do it over and over again. He had verbal tics, physical tics. But, I mean, the thing about him was that nobody ever said he was, you know, because of this, he was pathological. I mean, it was considered a kind of interesting, almost lovable eccentricity about the guy. So I think that the point is that if we did, you said, use the word relax, I would say if we had a more complex understanding of human behavior and psychiatric behavior, or behaviors we're calling psychiatric, that we might be able to lessen that onus on the burden of the person who falls off the cart. And I actually want to just mention one thing. I think that we live in a culture that is very obsessive. You know, we live, people who work in factories do the same thing over and over again. People in business, in offices, do repeated activities over and over again. We say that our best athletes and our best, you know, artists and actors and, you know, should be obsessive. So we have a lot of pressure on us. And many of us do very well with that pressure. I mean, I run marathons, you know, I write books. I mean, I manage my obsessions. But there are people who fall off the cart. And these are the people who don't handle the obsessiveness well, and they personalize it, and they take it on themselves. And we're, in a way, stigmatizing those people rather than seeing it as a broad, general, cultural activity that lots of people are involved in, and that that each of us handles it somewhat differently.
I want to make sure we spend some time talking at least a little bit about this historical perspective that you like to take. Now, you know, I think that in now thinking about the varieties of mental illness that seem to be common, things like depression or bipolar disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder or perhaps something like schizophrenia, those kinds of things, it's very tempting to think that if people experience those things now, there's every reason to believe that they probably always did, and that maybe in some way that we don't completely understand, that these things are part of the human condition, and that it, going all the way back to our early days as human beings, that you think, well, probably there were people who experienced depression, or maybe there were people who experienced mood disorders, or there were people who experienced very disordered thinking. But that's one of the questions, at least as far as OCD is concerned, that's one of the things that you question, this notion that, well, probably there have always been people who suffered with obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at the medical literature, a lot of it says, well, you know, OCD, it's global, it's worldwide, it's been, people have suffered it through all times and all places. And, you know, I'm a literary historian as well as other things. And, you know, if you look at, you start to trace, well, okay, what's the foundation for saying this? And you look in the medical literature, there isn't really any. I mean, there's a couple, you know, people point to Lady Macbeth, who actually didn't exist, you know, to a couple, one or two historical figures who might have had some of these behaviors. And then on the basis of that, claim that it always existed. So I don't think we have good historical information. The other thing, the other point that I try to make in the book is that, you know, there's something that I would call the symptom pool. And, you know, the symptom pool is just, what are the symptoms available to any group of people at any particular time? Those symptoms do actually change over time. There are symptoms, and in cultures, too. I mean, like, for example, you know, I spend a fair amount of time in Italy. And in Italy, people have livers. You know, they talk about their liver. How do you feel today? Oh, my liver is bothering me. No one in the United States that I know of ever knows where their liver is, and it doesn't seem to have much to do with their state of health. So culturally, there are different symptoms that one might pick. And then the way you organize those symptoms also change over time. So we have, you know, for sort of general psychiatric or mental discomfort, there's been lots of different terms over the years, from, you know, melancholia to neurasthenia to vapors and spleen, and you know, to things like OCD. And it's not, what's important is to understand in any given historical moment how we organize our symptoms. And if, again, I refer you to the DSM, you should take a look at it. It's online if you're interested. That these are groupings of symptoms. That's all it is. People have decided that this particular group of symptoms should be called this thing. So, again, there's always going to have to be a historical component. What's interesting to me as a historian is that I'm interested in the past. If you're a medical practitioner right now, you're actually not interested in the past. You're only interested in what the diagnosis is at the current moment. So there's a huge amnesia among practitioners about the history of what they do. And I always say, like, you may not want your plumber to know about the history of plumbing, but I think you really want your psychiatrist or your therapist to know about the history of the diseases that they're talking about. And I think that once you begin to get the long view, you understand that the diagnosis itself is a function of time and place.
Well, if we if we say that before there was the diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder, or before that there was something called monomania, and there were probably other ways of talking about it. Before we had a medical explanation of obsessive behavior, how did people talk about these symptoms? I mean, if we're going to allow that there were people who exhibited these behaviors, then if we go back before people started talking about what was going on in the brain and in the nervous system and so forth, well, then how did people think about individuals who exhibited these kinds of behaviors?
Well, I mean, you know, in Europe, in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and up until the mid 18th century, or at least the beginning of the 18th century, there is very clearly the role of demonic possession was very powerful, and in fact, the word obsession comes from this notion of demonic possession, because there's two ways you can be possessed by the devil. The first way, which was called possession, is that the devil controls you, has taken you over completely, and you are unaware of it because you're so much part of the devil. When you're obsessed by the devil, it means the devil has partly taken you over. You can make the following statement: I am possessed by the devil, which means that you're aware, you're rationally aware that you're possessed by the devil. And so the distinction between possession and obsession is very close. And so I think for a long time people had this sense of demonic possession. And in fact, if you look at the writings on, for example, melancholia, before the 18th century and even into the 18th century, the main people who wrote about it were divines. They weren't doctors. So the whole idea was that the care of the soul was really a religious care. You know, then in the 18th century, what you begin to see is the discovery of nerves. And once nerves became discovered, people had seen them in the body, but they didn't actually they thought they were sinews that just held things together. Once you begin to have an explanation of how the nervous system works, suddenly diseases all become nervous. And by the end of the 18th century, you have people writing that, you know, majority of diseases are nervous disorders. And once you move into the notion of nerves and brain, you see the rise of neurology and psychiatry. And the initial concerns of psychiatry and neurology were, in fact, this disease called monomania, which was another way of talking about obsession. And monomania, the whole definition of it is that your brain basically is okay. All the parts of your brain work, except one part, the mono, one part, is broken. And so monomania, one part either has undue emphasis, you know, we also use the term idée fixe. You might have a specific ruling passion or some idea you can't get out of your head, or it might just be some kind of error of your rationality. But so everything else is okay. Your brain is working, but there's just one thing wrong with it. Mm. And that's a very dominant definition through a lot of the 19th century. And then by the beginning of the 20th century, Freud takes it over and actually really, according to my analysis, founds psychoanalysis on both hysteria and on obsessive neurosis, which is the story of the rat man, and it's one of the founding ways that Freud began to talk about how the mind works. So the theme of obsession is actually very important in the development of psychiatry and neurology.
We are a little bit past our midpoint. I have a caller I want to get right to. Again, I want to introduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 15, 20 minutes. Our guest is Leonard Davis. He's professor in the departments of English, Disability and Human Development, and Medical Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's the author of a number of books, including one that deals with the subject here that we're talking about. The title of that book is Obsession, A History, and it is published by the University of Chicago Press. 333-9455 is our number. If you'd like to call in, toll free, 800-222-9455, and we have a caller in Sheldon. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
I've been allergic to things most of my life, although now that I'm a senior, it doesn't seem to affect me quite so bad. But some years back, I suddenly became allergic to wine. And I asked a friend of mine who was in charge of a fairly large wine making operation in California, if he had any idea how that could occur, and he says, well, the process for making wine changes, and I drink cheap wine, of course, and he says, just wait, it'll change again, and it did, but that allergy to the wine, I mean, just taking a glass to my nose, just smelling it, bothered me. That lasted for almost 6 or 7 years. And then they changed the process, and then I slowly could drink wine again. I'm not a big wine drinker, by the way. I'm a beer drinker. But so I'm thinking that a lot of disease that's new might be attributable to food processing, beverage processing, and so forth, particularly ADAC or whatever that's called with the kids. And I'll take my answer offline. I'm not sure that you even want to go into this area, but thanks for taking my call.
All right.
Sure. I'm going to take your question in a slightly different direction, but I think the question you have is, you know, do food allergies cause behaviors? And I think that's pretty clearly the case for some situations. But I think the important point you make is that in the past, the explanation for OCD was really sort of psychodynamic. It was within your mind. It, you know, Freud certainly had ideas about how early childhood development would affect a person and cause them to have OCD. The current line of argument is that it has nothing to do with you or what you did or what your mother did, but that it's actually it's a physical thing. It's a physical thing with your brain. And the problem is that there's something in your brain that's not working properly. And this is a very powerful argument throughout psychiatry right now. The problem with it is that, it's a simple argument. Because the idea is that if you find that place in your brain or that neurochemical that's not working properly, and you fix it, you will fix the person. But the reality is that the success rates for OCD are very, very low. It's almost impossible to cure OCD. You can just manage it, and you have bad periods and good periods. There are behavior cognitive ways of dealing with it. But the argument that, for example, it's a specific part of your brain, and now that we have all this fantastic neuro imaging devices, the first thing people are doing is looking at your brain and seeing, okay, using PET scans and fMRIs to say, can we find the place in your brain? Can we find, and a number of different people have found a number of different places. There's also people who are looking at the neurochemistry of the brain and saying, like, it must be too much serotonin, too little serotonin, too much dopamine, whatever. And a third area that people are looking at is genetics. There must be some genetic foundation. If we could find the gene or the allele that's common to people who have OCD, and none of this has been successful. I mean, there will be people who will tell you that individual researchers will say, "I found it" or "I've done it," but there's no agreement. And the reason there's no agreement, I think, what I'm trying to say in the book is that this is a very complicated behavior. It for example, OCD involves a number of different factors in the brain. It involves the ability to see and discern, so you might want to line up objects. It has to do with a feeling of contentment. It has to do with anxiety and nervousness about, your situation. And there's an addictive side of it, too. So the point about it is that, and then I'm arguing on top of that each era and each culture will define these things differently. If this is such a complicated human behavior, not a simple thing like producing a specific chemical, then it's going to be really hard to find the place in the brain or the specific one single chemical that's responsible for it. And it's going to be even more impossible to then say that everybody who has this OCD really has it because of this one thing. So, I mean, I'm arguing that we really need complicated ways to understand these kind of phenomena, and that diagnosis and even treatment tends to be very simple. It's just like, here's the thing that's broken, and here's the thing that fixes it.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know you're talking about OCD, but I wonder if you could just deviate for a moment and talk a little bit about postpartum depression and how it was dealt with in the past versus how it's treated today and categorized and so forth. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, can you do that?
No. What I can do, I mean, I'm not an expert in that in any way, shape, or form. But I mean, again, the way what I can take away from that question is the idea that there are postpartum depression is a disease that, you know, has come about at a certain moment. And you know, the interesting question, there's a guy named Ian Hacking who's written about this, and he uses the idea what he calls of a transitive mental illnesses, things that come and go. There are fads, you know. I mean, I think that there are diagnoses they have a half-life of maybe about 30, 40 years in psychiatry. I mean, they come and they go. Things have a new, you know, there are new names for things. They get organized and reorganized. Postpartum depression is one of those things, along with, as I said, situational affective disorder, which used to be called shyness and is now pathologized into that. So, you know, I think one wants to be careful and judicious about these categories. Again, I want to say it's not that they don't exist. It's that they... Let me give you an example, by the way, because I think this is useful. I'm actually arguing for the social constructedness of certain kinds of psychiatric disorders, right? And by saying that, when I give talks, I say, I'll come around to say it's socially constructed, and people will get up in the audience and say, look, you know, how can you say this is socially constructed? I have it. I suffer from it. And the example that I give, which I think is very understandable about the idea of social constructedness, is the example, I would say, for a dollar bill. And a dollar bill is something that doesn't exist in nature. It's something that is clearly socially constructed. Humans have made it. We've given it meaning, and so on. On the other hand, money is important. It's not because that it's socially constructed, it doesn't exist. Because it's socially constructed, it does exist in a particular way. And no one would ever say, well, money isn't important. I mean, people's lives get either made or destroyed by money. So in the same kind of way, I'm not saying that these diseases are just figments of people's imagination. I'm saying they're socially constructed, and we need to understand the ways that they come about. Again, it doesn't mean that people aren't suffering from them.
All right. To Effingham next, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, a couple of things. Has your guest ever read or heard of Wilhelm Reich?
I have.
And what is your opinion?
I'm not a Reichian, and, you know, I probably am not enough of an expert on him to give you a reaction that you would probably like. But I think he's interesting historically. I don't know. There aren't too many Reichians around right now, although I had a friend who used to have an Oregon box.
Well, I have not studied it in depth, but it begins to make sense. And then based on your last statement about money and how the dynamic of that has intervened instead of naked power, rather than, and you know, which converts to wars and all the other things that humanity has suffered because of the aggression that survival, in my opinion, begins to push forward, and how society deals with those things. Do you have any opinion about what should be happening? This morning's show program is all about symptoms. And do you have any ideas about what and how humanity and these days the rest of living things on this planet, which is being destroyed, and do you have any ideas concerning the advancement of the human intellect and practices that we are now engaged in, and this latest thing going on in the Middle East with the Palestinians and the Jews?
I'm going to have to pass on that one. I don't like to make pronouncements on that level, although we could do, certainly if we had a couple of beers, we could talk about the state of the world in that way. What I would say is that in terms of, you mentioned I'm talking about symptoms. I mean, I do have certain suggestions, and I think that one of them is that, that we might want to help. I mean, I think there is a kind of movement among people who are the are patients of the psychiatric system. I mean, they tend not to call themselves patients in this movement. They call themselves consumers, and they call themselves survivors. And there's a wonderful organization called mindfreedom.org, which you could check out online, that represents this. And, or for example, there are people with schizophrenia who are trying to understand that they can live with hearing voices, and think of that as one of their characteristics, rather than as a pathology. Or people with depression or bipolar people, people with bipolar disorder, who see themselves as having a kind of dangerous but interesting gift, because with the depression comes this elation, and so many artists and so on, or creative people have been diagnosed as bipolar. So the recommendation is more that we begin to think of people in a co-relationship with their practitioners, that it isn't just the practitioner diagnosing you, giving you a drug, and sending you home, but that there's a co-relationship that acknowledges the value, in some sense, of what your disorder, if you want to call it a disorder, is. And then I would argue that it would be very helpful to people, for example, who have OCD or are diagnosed with that, to know a little bit about the history of their disorder. And I gave a talk recently, and a man came up to me and said, you know, I've had OCD my entire life, and I've been to a number of different practitioners. And your talk was the one that made me feel like I have hope, because he was very excited about the fact that I was describing OCD as a rational disorder. It is rational because you're aware of what you're doing. And that he had a history, that there were famous people like Emile Zola and Dr. Johnson and, you know, Sir Francis Galton and so on, who had OCD and who used it very creatively. And to know that you're sort of in a complicated situation that's both cultural and medical, that you have possibilities, that it isn't just that you've been consigned to the graveyard of a particular diagnosis, I think there's a huge uplifting quality to that for people who are suffering, and are suffering for these complex reasons that we've been talking about.
We have maybe 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Leonard Davis. He is professor in the departments of English, Disability and Human Development, and Medical Education at the University of Illinois Chicago. He's authored a number of books, including the book Obsession, A History. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. So if you'd like to read more on this subject, you can look at that book. Questions welcome to 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. We talked a little bit earlier about how maybe one of the important points in the history of the way we think about mental illness was at that point, probably in the 1700s, when people generally abandoned the idea that people who were mentally ill were possessed and started thinking about the fact that there was something physiological going on. You know, it was something that truly was going on in the body. It was a kind of illness. It was a disease. Although then there seemed to be another interesting point where people went from thinking that someone could be mentally ill for physiological reasons and yet somehow not be aware of their illness or not be aware of themselves, to this point where we'd say that people could be actually mentally ill and aware that they were, knew that they had a problem, knew that there was something going on. Maybe they felt they couldn't control it, and maybe they could, in some respect, live their lives, but at the same time they recognized something wasn't quite right. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just thinking about how that fits into the way that thinking about mental illness has developed over time, whether that was an important kind of step for people to be able to take.
Well, there's a constant fluctuation in the history of disorders of this kind between the people who believe that this is a physiological thing, that it's rooted in the body, that it's a chemical process, to the psychodynamic explanations, which is more like there is conflict in your mind, that it's purely mental in a way, but mental without the idea of chemistry involved. That it's a purely mental set of conflicts and disorders. And those, you know, fluctuate every 20 or 30 years, and we still see that now. So that's actually kind of an interesting aspect of looking at anything over a long period of time, something like obsession. What we're seeing is that there's almost a conflict between those two models, because the current treatment for OCD is a combination of behavioral cognitive therapy and drug use, and that treatment actually speaks to the connection between the purely mental, that is behavioral cognitive, and the physical, the sort of use of the drugs. And there have been people, for example, who have examined using PET scans and fMRIs and have seen that the behavioral cognitive treatments actually create changes in the brain. The simplistic explanation that it's either one or the other doesn't allow for the really complex way that brains work. And the way that brain networks and chemistry and even electrical impulses work in the brain is much more complicated than we know. We're only at the very beginning of trying to understand this.
Mm. We're coming down to, we have a couple of minutes left. Maybe just one last idea, and this is something that comes back to this idea, perhaps, of how conditions like OCD and others have some socially constructed component. At some point, people started to think in the way that they thought about obsession, started to think about it the way we do now, and associated it, it seemed, with modernity, with modern life, that somehow there was this idea that it was a almost being obsessed, and being obsessed with being obsessed was somehow a condition of modern life. And that is actually something that, you know, I don't know when, if you say modern, what people think that that means, but that was something that certainly people were thinking about before the 19th century and probably actually in the 18th century.
Yeah, well, one of the points I make in the book is that one of the characteristics of OCD, of obsession, of OCD, is that you're rational and aware. And, you know, the earlier categories were totalizing. You were completely crazy, you were completely irrational. The development of the idea of partial insanity, or being rationally aware but being insane, in the 18th century really opened up this huge door, because suddenly, being crazy went from very few people in the culture to the majority of people. And in fact, you start seeing that the best and the brightest and the most creative and the richest people are the ones who are more likely to be mentally disordered than the sort of peasant farmer who's living this wholesome life in the countryside. So you get to a point where the idea of being somewhat crazy is actually equated with being a modern, intelligent person. And I think the example is the Woody Allen example, right? The neurotic is now our standard for what it means to be a contemporary citizen. I always ask people when I give lectures, everybody raise their hand who's not neurotic in the audience, and nobody ever raises their hand. So we all agree that being a little crazy is actually what it means to be alive. And that's a huge step, in the development of human consciousness.
Yeah, well, I think it's also interesting that some time back, again, early, the same time that we're talking about, maybe the mid to late 1700s, is also when we start to see the beginnings of what now is this commonplace notion we have about the thin line between genius and madness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and in fact, our very definition of what it means to be a genius is to be obsessed. And geniuses are very obsessed about what they do. That can push them over the edge, and that's always the sort of fear about genius. And in literature, we start getting stories about the mad scientist, and or the person who works too hard at their job and has a nervous breakdown. In fact, having a nervous breakdown from doing one thing too much was really the standard motif of 19th century biographies. If you think of the biographies of John Stuart Mill and Florence Nightingale and lots of other people, there's always a moment, Sir Francis Galton, where they have a nervous breakdown in the middle of their lives, and it's considered almost de rigueur that if you're really a famous person and if you're really a genius, you're going to have one of these. And you're going to have it because you're obsessed, because you've done one thing too much.
So now we are at the point where you ask the question that you ask at the end of the book, and that is, the question is, so what? So what, so what, so what? You put it like that. Like, well, in fact, now that we've taken this, tried to, here in the short amount of time we have, tried to take this look, and that you do in greater detail, about how it is we have thought about obsession, how we have constructed this thing we call OCD. Well, what exactly, though, does that tell us? I mean, what can we take away from this?
Well, I think, again, the takeaway message here is that we have to think as complexly about mental disorders, cognitive affective disorders, as we do about things like philosophy. We really need to see these things in their anthropological setting as complex objects. The gain on that is, I think, that people who have such are diagnosed with such disorders, you get a sense of themselves as actually not simply being damaged or broken, but being part of a large phenomenon, you know, like modernity. And I think that there might even be a kind of therapeutic effect for people knowing the history of their own psychiatric disorders. And one of the things I call for in the book, and I'm even beginning the process of trying to set something up myself, is an experiment, a quantitative experiment, in which you see whether being informed about the complexities of your illness and the history of it would have any positive outcomes in terms of how well you heal or cope with your condition. I mean, no one's really done that kind of work, and it's just assumed that, the way to do this is just administer the drug, do the behavioral therapy, and let the person sink or swim as they will.
Well, there we're going to have to finish with our thanks to Leonard Davis, our guest. He's the author of the book Obsession, A History. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. He is professor in the departments of English, Disability, and Human Development and Medical Education at the U of I Chicago. Professor Davis, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.